It's Chatter on Books, and if you think this introduction is boring, you try writing the copy. I'm Jamie McIntyre. Here's Story Clark.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Chatter on Books. I hope you are doing well and staying healthy. So many things to talk about. Right now, we have Claude doing all the important work. Award-winning Claude Jennings doing all the important work. David from D.C., and so happy to see Chuck Culpepper back, who I thought was going to see me in Vegas in a couple days, but he's back in Florida. Right, Chuck?
Palm Springs.
Palm Springs.
California.
Oh, okay. So you're making it slowly back.
Are you doing a tournament, Chuck?
I am in South Carolina on Thursday.
Cool.
Yep. Nice. Okay. When I need to fill out my bracket for the Tony Kornheiser show, can I get a little help? Just a little.
Yeah. Take a match or not. People don't use matches anymore, do they? Take a lighter. Some sort of fire implement. I don't know how those things work, but.
We will do it. Okay. In just a couple of minutes, we're going to be talking to the really talented sports journalist, Chris Herring, about this fabulous book, Blood in the Garden, The Flagrant History of the 1990s New York Knicks. And it's fabulous. And you don't have to care about the Knicks. You don't have to care about the NBA. It's just a fabulous book. And it was the easiest ever prep for the show because I just kept turning the pages down going, I want to ask him about that story. I want to ask him about that story. I want to ask him about that story because they're fabulous. So Chris will be telling us a lot of stories. But first, a couple of things to check in on. First of all, David, I've talked to Claude about this. David and Chuck, can you see my shirt?
Yeah.
Wow.
That is so cool.
Wow. Chuck, I know you're a world traveler. I know you've been to the Olympics and Palm Springs and you were in Vegas. I am in Pigeon Forge, Tennessee, which is most famous for David.
Dollywood.
The best place on earth. The best place on earth. So I'm here. I won't say it's an annual pilgrimage, but it's becoming an annual pilgrimage.
Wow.
Yeah. Do you pray at the Church of Dolly, Chuck? Because David and I do.
So
yeah.
Much so.
There's, spiritual leader. Everything.
There might be almost no one I can think of who's gotten life right more than she has.
That is exactly right. And she's got the theme park down right. She has transformed this part of Tennessee. I would dare say all of Tennessee.
Yeah.
Every time I tell a story about Dolly Parton to some family that has young kids, they say to me, they get free books from Dolly. And she's now given away 175 million books to kids around the world. She recently announced at Dollywood that if you were an employee, part-time, full-time, you could have worked there for a day. You could work there for 10 years, full tuition, college expenses, books, everything included. She's amazing. And then, David, did you hear the news today?
Yeah, about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, right?
Yeah.
She pulled out? Yeah.
She declined the honor of being nominated for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I have a theory. David, do you have a theory about why she decided to pull out?
My guess is because she wants to put out a rock and roll album in the next year or two. That's the theory of this case as I see it.
I'm sure she will. And Claude and I were talking before the show. In one of her statements, she said, among other things, that she's always wanted to do a rock and roll album, that her husband is a huge rock and roll fan and wants her to do it. I want to believe that she really does believe that she hasn't done it and she wants to do it and she will do it and she will do it in the right way. And
yeah,
of course we'll buy it. At Dollywood today, beautiful day at Dollywood. And they kindly let the thousands of people who were supposed to come to the park on Saturday, opening day of the park, who couldn't come because of the bad weather. They kindly said, come whenever you want. So tens of thousands of people coming through this theme park today. And she knows how to do theme parks. It's beautiful. The care they have for everybody. At the gift shop where I bought my wonderful shirt with that, which has just a touch of Dolly bling. It was hard to find, just a touch of Dolly bling. Her book, Run, Rose, Run, which is accompanied by 7 new singles, flying off the shelves. Absolutely flying off the shelves.
Just think about this in our miserable existence on this rock at this particular point in the history of mankind. Who doesn't like Dolly Parton? Everybody loves Dolly Parton, right? Like, who doesn't love Dolly Parton?
Everybody.
Like, I hate Dolly Parton. She's terrible. Like, who says that? Nobody.
Yeah. The level of detail. So I'm wandering around the theme park. And by the way, having gone to theme parks many times over with 3 kids, there's nothing worse than going through a theme park with 3 kids because they fight over where do we go next and how about this ride and whatever. You go by yourself. It's really delightful because you can go where you want, when you want. You can slow down. And there's this beautiful little wooden chapel. And you go in there and you look at this cute wooden chapel saying, no, this must have been something like what Dolly went when she was a child. No, she built it in honor of a doctor who delivered her when she was one of nine children living in the one-room house. The doctor who delivered her had these visions of setting up good medical care in Tennessee, and she helped him over the years, and she just thought he was such a wonderful person that she dedicated this chapel in his name.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, so someday. Okay, let's pretend the show is about books.
Okay.
Okay, I have two pop quizzes. These are two really interesting things that were in the news recently about famous authors, and I give Ron Charles credit and The New Yorker credit for these. But the first one is, just buzz in whenever you have the answer. This author was born in 1866, lived with their parents, I'm going to say there so you don't know if it's a man or woman, until 39 years old. Books are about the natural world, I guess is the only way to say this, in a very fun way. Have sold over 250 million copies thus far, just a few more than lipstick on a pig, and was one of the very first to create and patent and sell merchandise to accompany the books.
Jules Verne.
Nope.
Not Jules Verne.
Good guess, though. David always has good guesses. Mm. Think animals. Some of the most famous animals.
Oh, no, not Jacques Cousteau. Who could it be? I don't know.
Dr.
Okay.
Seuss.
What's that? No.
Dr. Seuss. Okay,
no, nobody gets a point. Beatrix Potter.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I would have taken 75 guesses to get to that.
Yeah, and her weird brother had all sorts of animals when they were kids, reptiles, rodents, everything. And they'd keep them, and then they would die. They would kind of do their own taxidermy and put them on the walls and things like that. Mm. But, yeah, she sewed when she wrote Peter Rabbit, Tales of Peter Rabbit. She sewed a little Peter Rabbit bunny and patented it. Who knew you could do that? And was kind of one of the first merchandisers.
Cool.
Okay. Second one, a little more recent. Lowell, Massachusetts wrote about originality and freedom and independence and being a crazy person.
Thoreau.
Oh, no, but you're getting warmer. And this person didn't learn how to drive until they were 34, despite the fact that much of their writing was about travel.
Mm-hmm. Jack Kerouac.
Yay, David.
Yay. I should have given Chuck a guess. I'm sorry, Chuck.
Okay.
I buzzed in twice.
Sorry, so Chuck. David wins 1-0. Okay, we talk often about books being banned on this show. What about assistant principals who are reading a book to small children and gets banned and gets fired because the book he grabbed, he was filling in for a speaker who didn't show up. You hate that when you schedule people on a show and they don't show up. The person who's supposed to show up to read to these kids didn't show up. So somebody tells the assistant principal, grab a book. And he grabbed a book called I Need a New Butt. B-U-T-T. Notwithstanding, I don't like that word. I think the book could be titled I Need a New Behind. I Need a New Bottom. But notwithstanding that, he got fired. What do we think of this? This is insane, right?
It is indubitably insane and short-sighted and all of the things that we hear from the same people that always try to ban the same books for the same reasons over and over and over again. And it gets tiresome to hear after a while. The book is literally a funny way of telling kids about a part of their anatomy that they probably think a lot about because they're kids. And that's what kids think about a lot when they're there at that age. And this is a funny way to kind of get the message across. So.
Great. Chuck Culpepper.
I read it and I just.
I know. Now, the good news is, the GoFundMe page, the fund has been started for this teacher who was understandably worried, just wants, you know, a job back. And the last time I checked, the book was number 6 on Amazon best-selling children's books.
Wow.
So, you know, as I say often on the show, I want to figure out some way for us to get banned just for a week or two.
You know,
good for business.
Yeah.
And for that to happen in a region where SEC football is allowed to persist is really something.
Good point. Okay.
Absolutely.
I want to be banned. Okay. Last one. And we couldn't get to this last week, but there is this increasing discussion debate among people who write fiction about how they incorporate COVID in their writing.
Yeah.
And do they include it? Because it was a big part of our lives in the last couple of years. Do they not include it? So characters and figures and elements in their stories don't have masks on. And this is easy for you guys because you don't do fiction, as far as we know, in your work. So this is easy for you. But if you were writing fiction, would you include COVID in it or not?
Okay. Sure. I wouldn't start a book saying I'm going to write a book about being in the COVID times.
Right.
But I think
too depressing.
Yeah, but it's understandable if you are an author that you might want to give your spin on what it's been like for people in the last 3 years and how it's affected people and maybe go in a different direction than most people would go. And that's fine. It's all the whole creativity of writing, right? So, yeah, sure. Why not?
I think I would. And especially if I were writing 5 or 10 years from now, because I always like to get a certain amount of perspective on something. And I think 5, 10, 15 years from now, we're going to really understand. Like, who knows what pandemic we're dealing with, if we're dealing with another one. But I think it takes that many years to really appreciate the impact of something that happens at a big societal level. So if I were writing the next year, no, but something 5, 10 years from now, I think I might. And I might want to focus on it because I think it's going to have an impact on kids. I think it's going to have an impact on how people work. And I think that will get reflected in the scenes and the situations you create in your stories going forward. Okay. Chris Herring, are you still with us?
I am.
Not if he's smart.
Yeah. Okay. As they say on Smartless, fire your publicist.
I'm having a day.
Fire your publicist. Chris is a nice man. I don't know what his title is. David Brown, very nice guy who helped out. So we thank David, who is on vacation right now. Okay, Chris, thank you so much for being with us. Know you're busy in so many different ways. But let me start with this. So many people know you in the sports world, from Sports Illustrated, ESPN, The Wall Street Journal. I could ask you 5,000 questions about what it's like to cover sports for The Wall Street Journal. But give us some of the backstory. Where are you from? Where did you grow up? What did you want to be when you were 5?
So I'm from Chicago, which for a lot of people that becomes one of the first questions or things they ask me about as it relates to writing about the Knicks during those years. Mm-hmm. But I was, when I was 5, I was, let's see, we would have been right there in 1990, 1991, talking about, shortly after Pat Riley was hired by the Knicks. So I was not of an age to have really captured or really understood the context around this team or even the Bulls when they first started winning championships. I really wasn't into basketball on a level where I could understand it and understand the context around it until maybe closer to when Michael Jordan won his 5th championship with the Bulls or so, maybe around the time I was closer to 9. Uh-huh. So, I think that context is interesting, but I also wasn't a diehard fan. For me, diehard fandom kind of means you love a team, win or lose, you live and die with them. I was willing to just live with the Bulls and not die with them after Michael retired, certainly after he retired for good and left Chicago. The Bulls went from being great to not very good at all. And I was not really along for the ride with that. But also by that time, they were not really rivals with the Knicks anymore. The players changed over. So I was not ever of an age where I could understand the context behind the Knicks and the Bulls having a rivalry, but grew up during those times. And I just thought that the Bulls winning a lot was, I thought just
that's
like,
what,
you know,
that's what they did.
I just thought, championship parades were just like the back to school parade and everything else because we had them every year in Chicago. So, so that was the time around which I grew up. And,
but did you want to be a journalist? Did you want to be an athlete? Did you want to be a fireman? Many authors always wanted to be astronauts. That was a big one.
I know for me, I wanted to be an astronaut for a long time. And I'm not sure how long that lasted, but I think we all, well, not all, but like, I think a lot of us go to that phase where you want to be an athlete. I was a pretty good athlete as a kid. I was pretty good at basketball and really, really good at baseball up until around the time I got to high school and curveballs started being a thing. And I was not very good at hitting breaking pitches.
Was there a moment, because these guys have heard me talk about this often, I have 3 wonderful, wonderful children. 2 of them really cute white kids from Chevy Chase, Maryland, who really, when they were younger, thought they're going to play shortstop or first base for the New York Yankees. And there's a moment, we know that's not going to happen, but there's a moment, and it usually was about 9th grade. You could just see this realization come over them. But at what was, do you remember the moment at which you realized you were not going to be playing professional sports?
I do. Probably not quite then, because I was really, really good in baseball. And, what it was, though? I played with a couple kids that actually were good enough to become pro in those sports and did. And when you play with them and you're like, man, they're really, really good.
Yeah.
And you get a chance to see, I don't know if you've ever watched the NFL Combine. They've started doing it more. They actually, like last week, even the week before, they were showing, they've got that technology now where they can show how fast one guy runs in relation to somebody else. And they can literally put them on top of each other and kind of, you know, almost like Photoshop them in, but show them in real time. And it's like, you're able to do that and see how fast they run the 40 versus you.
Yeah.
And really in my case, I'm, you know, I grew to be all of 5'9", 5'10", which doesn't mean you can't be a pro in those things, but it's not, you know, it's not to your advantage to be that short.
Not likely.
Relative. So my friend that went pro in basketball and got drafted in the lottery was 6'8", 6'9", and, you know, better shooter than me, better at dribbling, better at passing, you know, obviously better at defense being that tall. So you knew that. But to your question, though, it's really funny you ask, because I, like I said, I was very good in baseball, even with the deficiency of not being able to hit breaking balls, and was on varsity. And my, I, because of that realization that I had basically after, I would say, junior year, I told my baseball coach that I was going to quit the baseball team. When I would have had, you know, the starting center field position to myself. And my coach said, what, you know, and we wanted to understand why, because he had not really had that happen before. And I said, well, coach, I think I don't see myself becoming a pro baseball player. I've my whole life, I've wanted to go to the University of Michigan, like my parents did and where they met. And I don't even think, you know, at the trajectory I'm on, I'm not good enough to play there. Maybe I could play somewhere, but I'm not good enough to play there. So I would prefer to, my high school was really, I guess I was really fortunate. I went to a high school that had a baseball team, or no, I'm sorry, a school newspaper, a school radio station, and a school TV station, all within the high school. And so I did all three, but I started thinking to myself, like, I could actually see becoming a professional writer and covering, I would rather cover the team on the radio and in the newspaper than play for it when I don't have any chance to become a professional. So he kind of looked at me sideways, but he was like, okay. And I did those things. And obviously, you know, I guess had some foresight to know that I wanted to be a writer instead.
Incredible foresight. And think about him, because he usually has people and parents knocking on his door saying, I know I can make it. David, I forget, was there a moment when you realized you weren't going to be starting for the Bulls or starting for the Knicks?
Yeah, probably when I was 12 and Michael Beasley blocked my shot into the neighbor's rose bush.
Excellent.
I went, I can't jump like that.
Where is Michael Beasley today?
I'm not sure Michael's still with us. I don't think he's still with us, but nice kid. Nice guy, just a really good athlete. But all of us have that moment.
But was it really, was it that early, David? Were you enlightened enough? Was that early? Did you have the same trajectory that Chris had? Where you thought?
Unlike Chris, I sucked at everything I tried. I was terrible.
What else did you try? I forget. What other sports?
I tried to play baseball. Mm-hmm. I couldn't hit a fastball, much less a curveball. I tried to play basketball. I couldn't do anything against people who actually knew what they were doing. And then I went out, and I probably should have stuck with it. I went out for my high school football team, and I tried to block. I remember his name well, Elliot Lomax, he wasn't a pro, but he went on and played college football. He was a very good player, and I couldn't block him. I tried everything. I tried holding, grabbing. I tried everything. I couldn't block him. And I was an offensive lineman. My job was to block him. I couldn't block him. And I just, you know, I was never under any illusions that I was going to be an athlete of any import. So I knew that it was early. It was very early. This kind of just sealed it. And I just went, this is stupid. Why am I doing this?
But isn't it every boy's dreaming, thinking psyche when they're young, when they're really young, thinking this is right? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Some boys, I mean, but some of us realize early that we don't have it. Whatever that it is that allows you to be a good athlete. Like, I have two children, two boys. One of them, really good athlete. The other one, not a good athlete. I mean, it's pretty obvious. I don't think the one who isn't a good athlete is like, oh my God, I'm not a good athlete. He understands. You understand. You pick it up. You learn it quick. Believe me.
The only, as people listen to the show now, the only thing I ever wanted to do, Chris, was horses, for who knows why. But that was my thing. It's all I want to do, all I want to do, all I want to do. And when I was very young, the only thing I knew about horses other than reading Black Beauty was horse racing, because that was the only thing you could see on TV. So I thought, oh, I'll be a jockey, which worked really well until I shot up to 5'11". It's like, okay, well, that's not going to really work, right?
Yeah.
And then I tried another another aspect of it, hunters and jumpers, this craziness or whatever. And there was a moment, and it was at a great bar called the White Rabbit in Pinehurst, North Carolina, at 3 o'clock in the morning, where I had this, it hit me between the eyes like a 2x4, and said, and the horse world at the time still is a very big party scene. And I thought, okay, two things here. I'm not good enough to do this as a profession. And if I stay in it at this level, I'm going to die. So that's what made me go, like, take the off ramp, go do something else. Okay, this is fascinating. Okay, I'm sorry, let's go back to Chicago. You didn't go to New Trier High School, did you?
I did not, but my high school, which was in a different set of suburbs, compared itself to New Trier all the time. I think it wanted to be considered that way. But when I went to Michigan, I felt like the majority of the kids that were from the Chicago area went to New Trier. So Michigan, we had that conversation a lot. Yeah,
Michigan, pretty great. But then you've taught some at Northwestern, correct?
Yes, I do that when I've got extra time.
Have you gotten as obnoxious about Northwestern as Michael Wilbon?
No, because I think you probably have to have gone there as a student first to be that way, the way he is now, which I'm that obnoxious about Michigan sometimes, so I understand it.
Okay. Do you know, or David, do you know the story about one of Wilbon's nieces who played lacrosse at Northwestern?
Oh, of course. He's told me.
Okay.
I know all about it.
Chris Plott and Chuck, I mean, amazing nieces. We knew them very well because one of their babysitters also was a babysitter for our kids, fabulous woman named Vaughn. Anyways, and I feel bad, like, I can't remember what the niece's name was, but played lacrosse for Northwestern. Very, very good. And on a couple, at least two, she didn't always start, but she played every game. And at least two out of the 3 years she played, I think they were national champions in lacrosse. And she was wonderful about it and just loved being on and on. And Wilbon, he just, you know, there's not room for his head in the room when he was talking about them. But she decided between her third and fourth year, she wanted not to play on the team anymore. And because she felt as though, think about it, playing sports for a D1 school, a big sport at a D1 school, that's a job. It's a 7-day-a-week job. And she felt as though she never really had the opportunity to be a student. And I thought it was the most incredibly mature thing I'd ever seen a young person do, and incredibly aware of her circumstances. Well, and I don't know. I honestly don't know. I'd love to say Mike Wilbon just gave her an incredibly hard time. I don't know that he did. He was incredibly supportive of those girls. But I do know that she got pressure from teammates and coaches and others who said, how can you do this? But I thought that was something.
Absolutely. It was great.
Yeah, it was great. Okay. Chris, should we talk about your fabulous book?
If you want to. I'm just appreciative of you having me on, to be honest with you.
No, it's really fabulous. And I encourage anybody, all six of you listening to this podcast, you do not have to care about basketball, because this is about people and personalities. It's fabulous. It's Blood in the Garden, the flagrant history of the 1990s New York Knicks. So, Chris, as you were saying earlier, you were a baby when Pat Riley first got hired. You could, and given what you've done and what you've covered in sports, you could have picked any individual athlete. You could have picked any team. Why this team? Why that period of time?
Well, somebody, you know, I think the same way, you know, you asked the question, didn't you, like every kid, kind of want to be the pro athlete? Once people get into this line of work, where they become journalists, I think a lot of them decide they want to write a book. They don't necessarily know what that looks like or what shape that takes, but I told myself that.
Mm-hmm.
I told myself that, but didn't necessarily know what it would be about or, you know, when I would do it. And I started to figure that, oh, you know, because I cover the NBA, maybe it'll be a team that I'm covering, or, you know, if I live in the same city as a team that goes on a hot streak, that I'll, you know, I'll make it a point to try to, you know, kind of do that book where you tell the story of a season. I've seen it happen recently on the Buccaneers in Tampa Bay. You've seen it happen with the Nationals in DC and different things like that. It's not uncommon. But because it's not uncommon, you start to wonder a little bit, you know, that's something you kind of see a dime a dozen. So somebody approached me with this one. I guess kind of a really committed literary agent that, you know, just like anybody, a sports agent or anybody else that has conversations with teams or general managers or, you know, other people in the industry to try to get a sense of what the market is. Mm-hmm. So this literary agent was talking to book publishers and the heads of book publishing houses, basically asking informally, what sorts of books do you feel like you would love to see in the next couple of years that you think would do well? And I can go out and find writers that can maybe make that happen. And what he kept hearing repeatedly from a few of them was that, you know, all the publishing houses are headquartered in New York in this country, right, for the most part. And so a lot of the publishing houses are led by Knicks fans. And so they were really one downtrodden about how horrible the Knicks have been for the last 20 years. But that is in large part because of how great the Knicks were during the 90s, or at least very, very good the Knicks were during the 90s, and that they had a city that was just in love with them, still do, but just a very different sort of way in the 90s. And so he said, okay, that, you know, I've got my marching orders. Let me go find the writer to do it. He didn't know who would be a good fit for a project like that. Mm-hmm. So he started asking some clients of his, and one of them, his name is Jonathan Abrams, who's had a couple of bestsellers. And someone that I don't know all that well, but have just met maybe once or twice, pushed my name along without me knowing. He did tell me that he did that and then said, I think you should connect with the literary agent. Did that. And I had a conversation with him. I essentially said no a time or two.
Why
to
did
the
you,
project.
Can I interrupt and ask, why did you say no a couple of times?
Please. So this was late 2018. My dad had passed away really, really unexpectedly a few months before. I was still kind of just settling into living in Chicago. I'd moved from New York. You know, was not at the greatest place, with my girlfriend at the time, was just trying to really exhale after kind of a massive loss. And, you know, I was teaching and was in the middle of teaching when everything happened with my dad, and you can't really back out of that, you know, despite what you've got going on, you know, in your personal life. So I was trying to just stay afloat, really. There was just so much stuff happening. The NBA season, in the middle of the NBA season, there was just so much happening where it's like, I had so much on my plate and really no off ramp to kind of take some of the stuff off my plate. And so I said no a couple times. You know, I also think as much as you want to do a book, you're thinking to yourself, well, I want to do something that's kind of on my terms. It's my idea. And this was something that someone had kind of pitched to me that was handing to me. And so I said no. And then I thought about it more. I started making calls to people that had done this before and just wanted a sense of how heavy a lift is it. And you know, maybe something I didn't realize at the time, it also kind of can become an outlet to try to work through some of that stuff. I don't know if it's for everybody, but you know, I needed a lot of time on my own just to try to heal anyway. And in a weird sort of way, maybe it helped to do that. My dad had been someone, he had published several books as a professor, as a pretty well, well-esteemed, renowned professor.
What
in
did
sociology.
He write about, Chris?
He wrote about diversity. He wrote about racism. He wrote about public policy. He was a sociologist who used to lead the Black sociologist group, and you know, in the national level. So he was, I mean, he had written, I think, 8 or 9 books, and he would always ask me, and it had been published several times over, just in terms of, you know, and cited several times over. But he had always said, like, when are you going to write your book? You know, and he would throw out these book ideas to me, and I'd, you know, they were never good ones. It's
oh,
a lot different
they?
To
what
be
were
like
his ideas. I promise we're going to talk about Blood in the Garden a lot. I promise. But what were his ideas?
The only idea I remember him ever having that was good, and I was like, you know what, Dad, I'm going to ask about this. I'm going to circle back with you. He would just he always wanted me to write books that kind of fit more what he did. So it would be like, he knew that I used a lot of data in my work. I think David would tell you, like, that's kind of my, probably what I'm most known for in covering basketball, is that I bring a lot of data to the table to kind of make certain arguments, or to kind of show how well someone's playing or something like that, or to be quirky, to show how many times Kevin Durant's shoe has fallen off, or how many times someone gets hit in the face as a player, and can kind of have fun with it that way. So my dad always was pushing me to do that, but he wanted me to kind of write about disparities and stuff like that, which, look, it's completely relevant. I think what I was telling my dad is that stuff doesn't sell, you know, that all the stuff that kind of appeals to my dad, or appealed to my dad at the time, it's really hard to sell it to a publisher that wants to make money. You want to, you know, it's great if you can find something that is groundbreaking and important and meaningful, but also pushing the ball forward in terms of trying to, you know, shine a light on something that is the misdeed in our society. But the one idea I remember him having, he said, like, why don't you do something about LeBron and kind of how he's become such a businessman in the last few years. I was like, that's a great idea. And I took it to my agent, and this was years and years ago. And my agent said, that's a brilliant idea. He's like, do you have contacts within his orbit, LeBron's orbit, to kind of make that happen and to talk about his deal making? I was like, I do not. He was like, yeah, I didn't think you did. So Brian Windhorst has since written a bestseller on that. But Brian Windhorst, you know, basically came up with LeBron, you know, in his reporting and his coverage of the league. So that's the other thing I didn't realize at the time, is that you have to actually know these people are moving close enough circles to get people to speak with you. But anyway, he had wanted me to do a book before he passed. You know, he was not on his deathbed saying that or anything like that, but it was just something that he knew that I was capable of, that he had done. He wanted to see my work on a bigger platform, bigger stage. And so I didn't think about it at the time, but you know, I hope now that this sort of thing would have made him proud and my mom proud.
Oh, I'm absolutely sure. Let me jump to David for a second. And Chris, you don't know this, but one of the missions of this show is to still be alive and still kicking with the show when David does his first book. So yeah, David, I'm going to put you on the spot. If I put a gun to your head tonight and you had to pick a team and a season, one team, one season, about what you would write an entire book, what would it be?
I wouldn't do that.
Oh, God. No. I hate it when David doesn't like my questions.
It's been done. It's been done. Everybody and their mother has written a book about a season and wins and losses and all of that sort of thing. What I would do and what I would like to do is to kind of, and I want to hear Chuck, because Chuck's actually gotten a book published and I haven't, and Chris has gotten a book published and I haven't.
Chuck's turned into a pillar of salt.
No, he's still there. He's just listening.
There he is.
No, if I was going to do a book like that, I would not do a book about wins and losses in the season like that. Nobody cares about that. I would like to do a book, and I've told my wife this because she's much smarter than I am. I would like to do a book with my wife, who got a PhD in cultural anthropology from Northwestern.
I didn't know that.
Oh yeah.
I used to like her.
Funny.
She's way smarter than I am.
I used to like her. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I want to do a book with her. I would like to go spend a year with a football team.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't matter to me what football team it is, as long as it's that they play a regular schedule.
Right.
And write a book about interpersonal relationships on a 53-man NFL team. Mm. Because every year, a group of people come together and they decide we're going to try and win a Super Bowl. And almost nobody does it. Nobody can do it because it's really hard. It's incredibly hard to do. And football's different from the other team sports, all of which require incredible concentration, sacrifice, all of that. People who play professional football die much sooner than people who play anything else. They die. They die 7-8 years before anybody else dies. Any other group of people who play pro sports die.
Right.
So you have to really be committed to play professional football, because what you're doing is slowly killing you.
Right.
And so I'm always curious about why people decide to do that. What makes them do that? Because it can't just be the money. I know it's the money for a lot of them, but it's not the money for all of them, right?
Yeah.
And so I want to know what makes them do that and what makes a team work or not work. Because you all have to kind of say, we're going to put all of our personal BS aside to try and do this thing that's really hard to do, that's killing us.
Right.
And my wife is good at getting people to talk about stuff like that. And I would love to for us to embed together with a team, and we could kind of do it together.
That's an awesome idea. I'm going to start a GoFundMe page to get the funds.
Ask Chuck and Chris, who've actually published books.
Yeah. Chuck has done a wonderful book called Bloody Confused about the English Premier League and really what turned into a love affair Chuck has with football. So Chuck, you've done that. But if don't blow me off on this question. If you pick one team, one season, and you can come up with grander societal implications of that, what would it be now?
Can I pick an individual one season?
Yes, you may. Yes, you may.
All right. Because these ideas bounce through my head all the time in a little merry-go-round or whatever. Yeah. And the one that just came up this moment, it wouldn't be the one 5 minutes from now, but is I would one day in Abu Dhabi, when I lived there, I went to a camel race. and I would like to follow a camel through the whole season. And it was an astonishing day. And it was, you know, there's a race inside the track where the men, all men, who are they're wearing their distaches, you know, their beautiful garment the Arab men wear, and they follow the camels in their very expensive automobiles. And that race is almost as good as the camels who run 35 miles an hour. And that's what I want.
I think this is spectacular. Do you know about the camel beauty pageants and the corruption?
Well,
Huge deal. Right now, Chris Herring is going, David Brown, publicist, I am never working with you again. Exactly. What am I doing on the show? Well, no, this is a huge deal. And I encourage everybody
that's
to Google
insane.
It. It's spectacular.
Those camels can be kind of like the 90s Knicks a little bit.
Yeah. A lot of spitting, a lot of fighting. Yeah.
And there are so many levels of crime and corruption, including making small children ride the camels because they're lighter. And that's not supposed to happen. But there are camel beauty pageants. And I'm not kidding. These camels are worth hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars. And the beauty pageants are for camels are Vegas-like quality in terms of the production and the scale and everything else.
Hmm.
And not so long ago, you can Google this, there was a big bust because it turned out a bunch of the camels were being cosmetically altered with Botox to make, you know, their camel profile better. It was a huge, huge, huge deal. So you could write about that. Okay.
Wow. Wow.
David, I
actually did a spit take on the podcast. I actually almost did that.
Excellent. Right.
By the way, the children have given way to robots. Now they're robots on the table. I didn't mean to take the conversation that way.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Anytime the conversation goes to camels, I'm good with it. Okay. Years ago, and I feel badly, I can't remember his name because I knew this guy. A guy who used to write for Sports Illustrated decided that the cliche, David, he was going to follow a couple of teams for a season. Mm-hmm. And he decided to follow a couple of the teams that were most likely to win the Little League World Series. One was Hawaii, and I can't remember the other one. And it started out as this very rank and file, plug it in, you know, whatever. But the book was called Little League, Big Dreams. Mm-hmm. And it turned into this incredible statement about how corrupted youth sports have become in the United States and how terrible it is. And it's more about the parents and the coaches and the organizations than it is the kids. And it turned into become this advocacy piece saying, get parents out of youth sports. Like maybe you schedule the playing time on the field, but after that, let the kids be kids. So it was wonderful. Okay. All right. Back to Chris Herring's wonderful book, Blood in the Garden. Chris, I think I heard you in an interview somewhere talk about how you actually like the subtitle, The Flagrant History of the 1990s New York Knicks, better than the actual Blood in the Garden. Why is that?
I just think it has, and I've been told since then that that maybe the title itself does too, but I think it just, first of all, I came up entirely with the subtitle, so that's probably why I like it more. But I think it's got a double entendre to it, obviously, as far as the team literally, you know, mauling its opponents and, you know, bloodying their opponents physically, but also that there was some unsavory kind of off the court stuff that made them flagrant. And, you know, that I don't think that made them wildly unusual from different teams, but certainly more than, you know, there was excess. There was a lot of stuff in excess with this team. And the flagrant fouls were one, but also the flagrant behavior off the court was another.
Yeah. Okay. Chuck and David, jump in here anywhere because I've now exhausted my complete knowledge of the NBA and basketball. But was it, I think the level of violence of the 1990s Knicks and the physicality of their game became, it wasn't just a quality, it became a quantitative difference almost, right? And it changed the league. But was it, Chris, was it their own, it was the only thing they could do because of the amount of talent or lack of talent they had on the team at the time? Was it their only choice in terms of strategy?
I think it was probably their only choice as far as to win a championship. I think that, you know, I think stuff kind of gets lost over the years, and hopefully not too much in the book, that I certainly write about them as a team that they tried to make up for some talent deficiency with that style of play. I don't think they were talentless, that they had no talent at all. I was trying to write about them from the perspective that one team had Michael Jordan and the other team did not. And to try to make up for that difference in talent, because I'll put it this way, they made it to the championship round of the playoffs each of the 2 years, the first time Michael Jordan retired and then the second time he retired, the Knicks made it to the finals right after that. Mm-hmm. So I think that speaks volumes about how good they were. I just think that they weren't good enough to beat Michael Jordan without that style of play. And I think that right. gave them the best chance. So yes, they were utilizing it as a way to make up for that gap in talent. But I think they were good without it. They were not good on offense, but I think that they actually were a lot better than they get credit for on defense. And they had some legitimate skill on defense, not to mention that I think they had either the best or second best coach of that era who was in the Hall of Fame for how great he was.
Right.
So they had good things going on aside from just mauling people. I think that was certainly a big part of it. It was something that they sought out to do, but hopefully it doesn't come across in the book as if they had nothing else going for them at all.
Okay, but I said at the start of the show, I could just tick through so many great stories in this. There was a game against the Bulls in which three of the Bulls had to get taped up on the sidelines because they were so badly hurt. Then you have, I guess it was the marketing people or somebody like that for the Knicks who wanted to do a marketing campaign in which there would be the figure of a dead body on the ground, kind of, you know,
chalk
crime
outline.
Scene.
A
yeah, chalk the chalk outline. Outline of the figure on the body. So it became a thing. So, David, here's my question to you. If you're a Caps fan, as we are, and you have Tom Wilson on your team, if you have Tom Wilson on your team, you love him and you think he's the greatest guy ever. But you acknowledge that if he played for anybody else, you would hate him. David, 1990s, did other people, did other teams hate the Knicks because of this style of play?
I don't think hate is the right word. I think they were intimidated by them. And certainly their style of play led to a lot of the rules changes that have led to the league that you see today right. in the NBA. But it was going that way anyway, because the Pistons had already done that with the Bulls. And to Chris's point, the Pistons were more talented than the Knicks teams were. The Pistons had legitimate Hall of Fame players, Isaiah Thomas, Joe Dumars, really great players. But you had to be great to beat Michael Jordan. There's no other way you could beat him. And once Michael Jordan won one, he never lost again. I mean, that's the bottom line. Once he won his first title, he never lost again. And I don't count the 30-game comeback in 95 when he was clearly out of shape. That doesn't
count. Right.
But the Knicks came closer than anybody else did to knocking him off. That is certainly true. And they embraced it. And Pat Riley completely did a 180 from the teams he had coached in L.A., which was Showtime and fast breaks and
complete 180.
Lots of scoring and beautiful passing. To this team that just slugged it. They literally committed a foul on every play and dared the referees to call it.
And
it worked. It worked pretty good for them for a long time. And those great matchups that Chris writes about in the book beautifully with the Bulls and the Garden was just, boy, it was as great an atmosphere as you could ever be in for a playoff game. When the Garden, when the Knicks are really good and the Garden is really rocking, it is fantastic. And
New York.
Everybody should get that opportunity if you ever can to be at a game like that.
Yeah. Okay, Chris, talk about Pat Riley. And I think a lot of amateur sports fans, I count myself as one of them, kind of, you know, good looking guy, always dressed well, flashy, right? That kind of stuff. But quirky, really quirky. So tell some Pat Riley stories. The one about where somebody, I think, who worked for him was going to buy a car and he was so upset that they were going to buy it in the wrong color. Can you talk about that?
I'll do you one better. The guy that you're talking about was someone that Pat Riley worked for. This was Pat Riley's boss, who Dave Checkitz is the president of the Knicks. And he had just hired Pat Riley a few months before. They were having lunch and Dave Checkitz's wife calls him and says, Dave, I told you I was going to go get a new car for the family, a new SUV for the family. So I'm trying to figure out whether to get, you know, what color to get. She was getting a Chevy Suburban. She went to get one that was forest green. And she says, Dave, is that okay with you? And Dave says, that's fine. But Pat Riley can overhear the conversation because he's sitting within earshot of the phone. And Riley, you know, somehow finds that it's his place to tell his boss, Dave, she can't get that color car. And Dave Checkitz starts laughing, but Riley is completely serious. And says, green, that's the color the Celtics wore. That's the color they wear. You can't get a green car. And so, again, Checkitz thinks he's, you know, just joking, but he's completely serious. So he more or less waits there and stares at him until he tells his wife that that's not an appropriate color. So he says, okay, do they have anything else? The car dealership says red is another option. She's fine with that. Dave Checkins is fine with that. Riley is even more. He's like apoplectic that that color would even be under consideration because obviously the Bulls wear that color. So then Dave Checkins tells his wife, don't come home with anything other than a blue Chevy Suburban, because that's all that Pat Riley will be okay with. But I think that speaks to the way he views betrayal to some extent, that like you have to be on exactly the same page as him, and that, you know, the rules that he laid out informally or formally were, if you, first of all, he wanted his players knocking other players down from other teams, right, as a show of intimidation. If you knock them down, and when you knock them down, you do not help them up. If you help them up, I'm going to fine you $500. The idea that he was walling off his team psychologist from the players that the psychologists had gotten to know before Riley was there. The idea that, you know, down to the color scheme of your car, that, you know, that you cannot in any way show a kinship with the enemy or the opponent. The fact that he was not going to let a beloved player like Clyde Frazier, who was a team broadcaster at the time, fly with the team. The fact that he was not going to let his scouts that worked for the team come and watch practice without prior approval. He was doing everything he could to basically make it us against the world, in a way that I couldn't understand. And I think even some of the people from that team have said, I don't know that we needed to be that, you know, isolated and insulated. But okay, Pat wanted it that way because he was paranoid. He was completely paranoid, but he wanted his guys to feel like he wanted them to almost be starved in a way, like and crazed in a way. And this was a coach that was showing his players videos, like in one particular game against the Blazers, who were one of the best teams of the early 90s, videos of like car crashes and Rams headbutting each other violently without him having to say anything, basically because he wanted to work them up and build them up into a violent sort of mood before they played a game defensively, because he thought they'd been playing too soft in the games before that. So that's the way the guy was wired. He was big on messaging, and he was big on kind of the intent behind this stuff and wanting them to kind of think a certain way.
The more I read this book, I more love Pat Riley. And he was ruthless at intimidating with his players and everybody around them. But then he takes the team to Reno because he thinks they need a kind of a bonding exercise, and gives them $10,000 out of his own pocket. But Chuck, let me ask you something. And then Dave, if you know one, and Chuck, you've covered so many different sports. Is there another coach that was this, and we'll put Belichick in a completely separate category, but another coach this influential, this driven in a certain strategy that you've covered?
I would say Nick Saban at Alabama, maybe. It's not the same strategy, but it's the fight against human complacency.
Right.
This campaign against human complacency. It's been going on for a long time now.
Yeah.
And the idea that you might have a bunch of titles, but you never really talk about them, and you just sort of continue. You know,
I think the only thing that ever kept Nick Saban from being completely ruthless is he was coaching college kids. And there are so many rules.
And his wife is just one of the finest people in the, probably helped keep him from being completely ruthless too.
There we go. As we all know, Alabama fans were nice to my kids one day, so we have to be nice to them. David, ruthless is the wrong word. It's my word, but a coach this driven.
Oh, I think most of the great coaches are driven this way. They're just not as successful as Pat was. But most of the great coaches have a screw loose. I mean, Joe Gibbs was completely crazed and slept in the office 6 days a week and never saw his kids and never, you know, all of the great coaches who win. Parcells was the same way. I remember going to league meetings in Hawaii it was literally a month after the Patriots had won the Super Bowl for the third time in 4 years, and asking Belichick about, well, you know, how do you, you know, what do you, how do you talk to your team about winning another Super Bowl? And he literally says, what Super Bowl? And I said, the one you just won a month ago. What are you talking about? It's like that. I don't even think about that. It's over. It's gone. That season's done. We're off to a new season. You know, they're mole. It takes a special person. And Riles was as crazed as any of those guys about winning and doing the things that you think your team needs to do. Cause you got to, Isaiah Thomas told me this a long time ago. He said, to win a championship, you've got to go to dark places. You got to go to some dark places.
He wasn't wrong.
And that's exactly right.
And I think it's really noteworthy, too, that, you know, and we obviously know this, but like Pat Riley still is doing this. And he's a 70. He'll be 77 later this month. And people talk about, like, how much longer are you going to do this? Because this man has now been in the sport for more than 50 years. And he's essentially said, until we get the next one. And by the way, you know, he has a team that is in first place now, and that is post losing LeBron James and Dwayne Wade and Chris Bosh. And the, you know, so, I mean, he's done it with completely different teams, with completely different levels of talent, sometimes with, you know, the most talent. But I don't think that, you know, Miami is certainly talented now, but it took a lot for them to build their roster this way and a lot of efforts and some trial and some error, but he's still driven. And, you know, what I think is so interesting is that I came away from the book, you know, writing the book, going from thinking, worrying, man, I didn't speak with Riley for this book. And now I'm wondering, do I have enough on him? And then most people saying, you know, after they read it, wow, like you really do not pull punches with the way you talk, you wrote about Riley. And I'm sitting there thinking, like, I didn't think I got enough on him at all. But then stepping back and really reading it, I'm saying, wow, this is a kind of like a tough portrayal. And one of his, I won't say friends, but somebody in that organization saying, I just bought a copy of your book. Can you sign it out to Pat? I'm going to give it to him as a gift. And I asked the person, I said, are you sure Pat is going to want this as a gift? Because of the way it's written in the portrayal, which I think is more than fair. He got a list of, you know, fully fledged questions, well before the book came out, even after he said no, thank you to being interviewed, even after I spent close to a week in Schenectady where he grew up and talking to his childhood friends. So I certainly did my legwork on this. But what his friend was telling me was that, and people that watch The Last Dance, the Jordan documentary, may be able to relate with this. There's a portion of that documentary in which Michael actually starts to tear up a little bit when he talks about how badly he wants to win. Mm-hmm. And that he has punched teammates and he has yelled at officials and he has gotten into it with his coaches and he has called the people that employ him out of their name. But that's how hot the fire inside of him burns.
Yeah.
And Riley is exactly the same way. And what his friend of mine told me is that you don't think Riley knows that about himself. Like there's nothing you could write as long as it's true. There's nothing in there that you could write that he doesn't already know about himself. And like, he'll almost respect it more if you get to the essence of who he is and outline all that. So I don't know, you know, I have not heard from him yet. I don't know if I'll hear from him ever, but you know, I think that's just the way he is. And I think that's still the way he's wired, quite frankly.
You got him. That's exactly who he is.
Okay. And as somebody who didn't know him and didn't know him well and had a very superficial understanding of Pat Riley, I like him better. I like him better because I do think it, whether it's sports or business or government or anything, the hardest thing is to be really good over an extended period of time, right? It's the hardest thing. And I came away from it liking him more and admiring him more. Wow. Okay. There's so many things I want to ask you about this book, Chris, but we're going to run out of time, but let me get you out with this. You teach young aspiring journalists. You cover sports at the highest level. You spent 3 years working on this book, right? When you were working on this book or from what you did learning and writing and researching this book, how has it changed, if it has, how you will cover sports going forward?
I know the answer to that. And maybe this is me, the fire starting to burn in me a little bit after writing about Pat Riley. So when I pitched the book, you know, I'm 35. So when I took over this, I was, you know, 31, 32, whatever it was. And you obviously have to take the book to different publishers and the proposal for it to different publishers and ask who's willing to bid on it and how much and, you know, what the terms will be. And we had plenty of bids on it. So, you know, in no way was I going to be left out in the cold. We just had to pick a, you know, an offer. But there was one person that that looked at our proposal that knew of me already. Again, these are people that are Knicks fans. And I covered the Knicks for the Wall Street Journal from 2012 to 2016. So some of them were already familiar with me. And one of the people was kind enough to say, I know I might be making a mistake here. One, because I really like Chris and I really like his work. I love his work. I've read his stuff at the Wall Street Journal for years, or, you know, as a Knicks fan, but I'm going to politely pass on the opportunity to bid on this book, in part because, keep in mind, earlier in the pod, I was saying that I had a little bit of a quirky reputation as it relates to what sorts of stories I chase, where I'm writing about, you know, again, Kevin Durant's shoes falling off and why that happens. And, you know, obviously kind of bringing it all to a head to explain exactly what the reason is, but, you know, taking kind of a winding path to get there that encompasses not only why his shoes fall off, but also the way Kevin plays and the fact that, you know, Kevin wears his shoes in games a lot longer for weeks at a time, whereas a lot of guys change their shoes out every game. And the reason he does that, because he grew up, you know, far from privileged in that way. And so he, you know, he was not used to having a whole lot as a kid. So I weave different things in there, but my way of writing has always been a little bit different when I do longer form stuff. So this person from the publisher said, because the stuff Chris chases is quirky and different and unusual, that I think plays very well for the stories he writes. But I'm not completely sure that would hold up well for a narrative 350, 400 page book. Wow. So I'm going to very politely pass here, readily understanding that I might look like an idiot, depending on how the book does and how it's reviewed and everything. But like, I have no doubt he may prove me wrong. So that was a big, you know, again, we talk about Jordan and Riley and the idea of needing to show people and needing to prove something to people. That ended up being a pretty good motivator for me beyond just the idea of doing a first book to begin with. But I think in some ways, you know, having to organize and structure more than 200 people that you've interviewed and trying to tell a story in a way that keeps people turning the page about a team that a lot of people didn't like or didn't love, about a team that's older, about a team, frankly, that never won anything. Which I think makes them more compelling and more interesting than, you know, teams that won everything like the Bulls, which we've seen a lot on during those years. But to me, that now is like something that, you know, since I started working on the book project, I took a job at Sports Illustrated, and I've written longer form stuff every now and then, but I think, you know, it's probably opened my eyes to the idea that there's literally no reason I can't do more of that. And that I should take this opportunity to do more of it, because quite frankly, I didn't want to be pigeonholed ever, but certainly not at 31, 32, which I think that was kind of what the guy was saying in a, you know, maybe not quite as harsh tone, but the idea that like, I've kind of seen who I think he might be as a writer. And if that's all there is to it, I'm not sure that's book worthy. And so, you know, to take the opportunity to prove that wrong, but not just with the book, but with actual stories too.
Oh, it's a fabulous story. David, that's another topic for a book. Motivation. You know, we talk about fame sometimes, but motivation and how it impacts people. Chris, it's so fabulous. Blood in the Garden is so fabulous. I'm not going to subject you to 60 seconds more because it's just too embarrassing at this stage of the game. But can you give us a hint about what the second book will be?
I hope so in the next week or two. We are literally negotiating that now. I can't give you that, but what I can tell you about the stuff that I thought about, which everybody, I think when you have success with the first one and this one, you know, had the bestseller list. And I think at some point, you know, we're in talks to try to land a docuseries, which I think we'll be able to get. But because of that, then you're like, well, what can I do now that I know how much that was a lift? And so what can I do now? So I started thinking about other teams I could write about. And I started thinking about teams from that era where there's a little bit of a nostalgia factor. You want to find ones that are colorful. I started thinking about teams that maybe didn't quite win. And so I was thinking about different ones. So I was thinking about the Atlanta Braves of the 90s that had some interesting personalities, but won a lot, but didn't win nearly as much as they were expected to, given how much they won. Didn't win as many championships as they were thought to have, you know, maybe should have won. Thought about Ken Griffey Jr. I thought about Deion Sanders. You know, different people. I ended up not settling on any of those. Like I said, I will not say just for now. I want to at least finalize it first before I say it out loud. But thinking something else NBA and hoping to lock that in, honestly, within the next week or so.
Excellent. You'll have to come back and talk to us about it. Chuck Culpepper, you're going to have to come back and talk to us about your camel racing book.
Please.
Fabulous. I want to intern for you. I want to be your assistant when you're writing that book, Chuck. Chris, I travel well. I'm good with big animals. I want to be your intern.
I'm just glad Chris wasn't done at 31.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. God, 31.
He had other conventions, you know.
But I first traded texts with David about having Chris on. He says, "Oh yeah, he's a very nice young man." I was like, "Oh my God, he's so young." David's going to come back and talk to us about he and Diane are going to embed with the Commanders.
Please do.
No.
That one may never happen.
God, no.
That was so horrifying.
Love of
Might
God,
require man. An ownership change. We'll see.
All right, everybody.
31 other teams. I'll find one.
The book is Blood in the Garden, The Flagrant History of the 1990s New York Knicks. I say it again. You may never have watched a basketball game in your life, but it is a fabulous book about fabulous personalities and a really interesting time. I hope you all go out and get it. And Claude, thank you for doing all the hard work as ever. We are back next week with a really interesting guy named Gary Tange. I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly. And David, I think I'm a Boston sports journalist, an actor, shows up in a lot of different things. And he's written a book called The Arm in the Fall, which is a terrific novel. My favorite review of it thus far says, if Quentin Tarantino had spent 30-something years as a sportscaster and decided to write a novel, The Arm in the Fall would have been the result. So we will have him back. Chris Herring, thank you. Chuck, David, love you all, man. Claude, thank you. Everybody, stay well. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next week.